Welcome to the Vernuccio Novak Report and the American Political Zone. From New York, this is Frank Vernuccio.
And from Washington, this is Daria Novak.
And from Tokyo, it is a fascinating time for Japan. Japan is about to elect its first female prime minister, an interesting event in and of itself. The leading Liberal Democratic Party has been the predominant political party in Japan pretty much since the end of the Second World War. Sanae Takaichi will be the next prime minister based on her leadership of that party, and it's going to have some interesting consequences. Sanae Takaichi is a realist when it comes to Japan's place in the world. She's looking at the dire threats coming to Japan from both North Korea as well as China, and she looks to be taking steps to protect her nation from those urgent threats. Now, of course, Japan, since the end of the Second World War, has had a peace constitution. And while Japan does not see any possibility of foreign entanglements at this point, its ability to defend itself from those threats has been gradually being strengthened. Despite that peace constitution, Japan has a quite strong national defense system. It's about to get a lot stronger, I believe. It's interesting, Dari, how including one weapon system, the F-35, has really changed Japan's self-defense posture. That weapon allows many ships in the Japanese Navy to be used almost as light aircraft carriers with the vertical takeoff and landing version of the F-35. Dari, you've spent time in China. You are very well familiar with the Middle East, with Asia. How do you see this developing for Japan in the next couple of months?
I think this is a very positive movement for the United States. We'll see that Washington, I'm sure the Trump administration, will come out and say that this is positive and that we expect to form a closer partnership with Japan. We expect probably that there'll be more burden sharing financially, which of course this administration would delight in seeing. They've been pushing for that. The new prime minister is also talking about constitutional changes to allow Japan to spend more money. If that occurs, I'm sure that the United States would also welcome that. One of the things that we do need to think about is whether Japan is going to seek increased independence or more autonomy or self-reliance as we move forward with their policies. Of course, they'll be aligned with the U.S., but we have to see where it falls on that. She may push for more self-reliance in deterrence. In other words, that Japan will be able to handle more of their own affairs. That idea of potentially sharing the burden, I think, is going to be very welcome change for the U.S. Economically, there are probably going to be some increases potentially in conflicts in the trade area that we might see. That's probably the only, I would say, probably really big, really big change that we might see down the road. And that would be more or less related to currency manipulation and things like trade advantage by Japan. We've been through trade wars with Japan in the past. We've got a history of it. We work through it. They're minor conflicts. So I don't really think that that's going to really impact things negatively. Now, with Japan's foreign policy toward China, I think we're going to see Japan become more aggressive when it comes down to the Senkaku Islands. There'll probably be more confrontational toward China over these. These are contested islands between China and Japan. We probably will see a closer alignment between U.S. and Japan over Taiwan, which is another positive development, I think, for stability in Asia if Japan aligns more closely with us there. The prime minister does face some domestic constraints. So how fast Japan is able to move on each of these things is a little bit up for debate at this point, obviously. Her domestic challenges are things like Japan faces very high debt right now. Cost of living is pretty high. And She may have some issues with the number in the majority in the Diet in Japan and their Congress as to how far she can push legislation through. If Japan becomes very strongly aligned with the US against China, I think the challenge for Japan may be how to balance their relationship with China. There could be some diplomatic blowout in those areas. So, if you take all of these things into consideration, Frank, I think this is a very good move as far as US-Japan relations go. And I think that it will be very welcomed by Washington. We like the idea of Japan and self-reliance, especially when they're aligned with the same goals that we have anyway.
One of the good aspects I think could come from Takeuchi's policies is achieving the dream that American presidents, I think of both parties to some extent, have had for quite a long time, which is the establishment of something like a Pacific version of NATO. I think with the Japanese arming to a more significant extent than they have in the past, you're going to see, I think, countries like Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, and Taiwan being more willing to openly work together. And I'm going to include something that might be surprising to some Americans in that as well. It's a possibility that even Vietnam might be more comfortable allying more closely with an anti-Chinese version of NATO than they have in the past. I think those countries that I've just mentioned have all been, to some extent or the other, been intimidated by China. But I think a strengthened Japan combined with a continued American umbrella will provide, I think, the encouragement for the establishment of that Pacific NATO. And that could certainly tip the balance to a significant way. One of the things I think that is not being given enough attention is China's rise to becoming a significant nuclear power. There is, I think, some somewhat to me distressing talk of a new or an extension of the US-Russian nuclear pact. Now, part of the problem with that is that I think there's more of a threat from China than there is from Russia at this point in terms of nuclear power. To come to an ideal concept of limiting nuclear weapons based on a deal with Russia without including China in limiting nuclear weapons is a real threat to national security, both for the United States and our Pacific allies.
To your first point on a regional security architecture, I think this would be welcomed not only by the United States, but also by India and Australia. I think that what the US would also like to see in that regard is Japan take more of a co-chairmanship type of role in a security architecture with the United States to form a real partnership that way and co-lead the Indo-Pacific region. I do think that there will be some challenges, as you talked about, with China and nuclear issues and balancing what Japan is able to do without causing some type of inadvertent conflict to take place. It's going to be a balancing act, but I think the burden sharing, I think, is incredibly important that Japan is willing to pick up what the United States just can't do everywhere in the world. We cannot be a security partner and provide security for every single nation. We need to partner. And I think that's what we're going to see with this new prime minister. I personally like the idea that they have a female in there. I think that may change the dynamic a little bit too.
Well, speaking of absolutely dynamic and outstanding females, we are so privileged and so proud to have with us today Claire Lopez. Claire Lopez, of course, works with United West. She is a strategic policy and intelligence expert with a focus on the Middle East, one of the most intelligent people we've ever had on the program. Claire, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm very glad to be with you.
Now, we've seen some interesting news about a possible deal with Hamas. And I wanted to ask you, going back to the history of attempted deals with the Palestinians, they are an organization that has never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. You actually see this deal coming to fruition.
I really want to be cautiously hopeful. cautiously optimistic about this. I know that there are teams at the working level meeting, beginning actually yesterday in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, and that some of the key principals, to include Ron Dermer coming from Israel, and from the United States, President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, plus envoy Steve Witkoff will be arriving. There is already a representative of Hamas who came in from Doha, from Qatar, and that is one of the surviving leadership figures of Hamas, Khalil al-Hara. We'll see where this goes this week. Already, though, I would note that the deadlines that President Trump had laid out when he first spoke about the 20-point plan with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office in the White House, more than about a week ago, about a week ago. At that time, it was laid out that Hamas had 72 hours, that is 3 days, to accept the 20-point plan. Well, that brought us to Friday when Hamas, in fact, did issue an official statement accepting the 20-point plan. And that would have started the clock again for 72 hours, which would have brought us to about Monday. That was the 6th of October yesterday. And they're still kind of talking. And Hamas has also let it be known that they don't even know where some of the hostages who were supposed to be released within those 72 hours, they don't know where they are, that they've lost contact or something with their captors. It's a little hard to be optimistic, but let's hang in there. As long as President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu do, we can too.
Claire, you have had such an incredible background, and not just sitting behind the desk. You've actually been out in the field. You know the area. You understand the people in the region. So, with that in mind, I want to know, do you think whether it is a two-state solution or some other one that they've been talking about in Washington, can it work in the long run? Can If you want to call it Hamas or the Palestinian area, can it coexist with Israel?
No, of course not.
So
No,
what?
absolutely. I mean, obviously not. First of all, there's no such country as Palestine. There is obviously, therefore, no such people as Palestinians. Never has, never will be. Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very clear that there will not be another experiment with a jihadi Islamic state next door to Israel. They've already had a couple of chances. The first chance was back in the 20th century, when after World War I, the British were granted by the League of Nations, and then later on the United Nations, successor to the League of Nations, the mandate for Palestine, which up until that time meant that was the Jewish people's land. That was to be the land that would be developed into a modern day and recognized as a modern day nation state in that area that is no longer, it was no longer at that point owned and operated by the Ottoman Empire, it having been defeated in World War I. However, the British, instead of developing and preparing that parcel, that mandate for the new internationally recognized Jewish state, instead gave over 70, 75% of it away to the Hashemite clan that had fought, yes, by the side of Britain against the Ottoman Empire. Remember Lawrence of Arabia and all of that story, right? They had fought side by side with the British in Arabia against the Ottoman Empire. But that Hashemite clan then was kicked out of its long-time position as what they call the Sharifs of Mecca. And that happened because Ibn Saud, later giving his family name, clan name, tribe name, Saudi to Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud at that point in the early 20th century was consolidating his conquest and rule over the entire peninsula. So, long story short, the Hashemites get kicked out of Mecca. The British, feeling sorry for them that they owe them something because they fought with them against the Turkish Ottoman Empire in World War I, carved out 75 or so percent of the British mandate that was supposed to go to the Jewish people and gave it to the Hashemites. That is what we today call Jordan, now with King Abdullah on the throne. There never was a Jordan in the history of the world before that. The name is taken, of course, from the Jordan River, which flows to the western side of now what is the country of Jordan. The remaining little bit of land that the League of Nations, United Nations, had designated for the Jewish people then became the modern day state of Israel, Ben Gurion, and the leadership of Israel, May 15, 1948, accepted that small bit and said, yes, we'll take it. We will build our nation, our modern day nation state of Israel there. And so they have done. So Jordan becomes the first two-state solution, right? It's next door to Israel. It's been granted nationhood, recognized internationally by eventually the United Nations. That was the first chance. Did they call that the two-state solution? No. Then they got a second chance. And that second chance happened in Gaza. And Gaza, going all the way back to the Bible, that is the Tanakh, the Old Testament, as Christians would call it, was land that was part of the Promised Land. And that was land that Moses, Joshua, led the Israelites through on their way, Exodus out of Egypt, what, 1400 or something years ago. So it was always part of Eretz Israel. But after the War of Independence by Israel, which it won, that land was occupied by Egypt. So Egypt had that land, the Gaza Strip, from about 1948, 49, all the way until 2005, when then Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, decided to evacuate every last Jewish person out of Gaza. So during all of that time, let's say 1949 to 2005, Gaza Strip was under Egyptian administration. They could have built their second state solution there, but they never even tried to do that at all. So by 2005, the Jewish presence is completely removed out of the Gaza Strip. By 2006, there are elections. The Gazan people elect Hamas over the Palestinian Authority. By 2007, the Palestinian Authority remaining people are being thrown off roofs, and that was the end of the PA's presence and authority in the Gaza Strip. It is Hamas administered, essentially self-governing, okay, from let's say 2005 all the way to October 7, 2023, which we commemorate today. as that horrific Shabbat massacre carried out by these Islamic jihadi terrorists called Hamas, which is the Gazan branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. But all of that time, 2005 until 2023, they could have declared that the second state solution, but they didn't. So I think that's enough chances. And every time that there was that opportunity for another jihadi Islamic state, it came to naught. So I think that's probably enough. And no more talk of a two-state solution. Forget about it. Not going to happen, nor should it.
If you're looking at this from an individual person living in Gaza, an individual Palestinian, if you want to use that phrase, you constantly see money flowing to the PLO or to similar organizations as their leaders live lives of luxury. If you go back to Yasser Arafat, living a life of luxury in Paris, now Hamas leaders living a life of luxury in Qatar. Is there a point at which the average person who we might identify as Palestinian, is saying, enough of my own leadership? I really want anything but this.
Well, no, not at all. And the reason is that they had their chance to vote back in 2006 and chose Hamas. Now, who are Hamas? Who are the Hamas terrorist fighters? They are the husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers of the Gazan people, who, by the way, are around 80% Egyptian by heritage. There's no such thing as Palestinians. That is a name that, as we know, was first dredged up by the Romans in the conquest after the 135-36 Bar Kokhba revolt of Judea, homeland of the Jewish people. And the Romans, having put down that revolt, decided to erase even the name of the Jewish people from the land, went back to the Tanakh, found the name of the Philistines, who, by the way, were Indo-European people, sometimes called the island people, who came to that all along the southern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea after the end of the Trojan Wars. And they were biblical enemies, of course, of the Israelites. Well, the Romans dredged that up and decided to call Judea Philistia. Well, that was the first time that that name kind of, is applied to that land. And then we fast forward to the early 1960s when Yasser Arafat, whom you've just mentioned there, Frank, teams up with the KGB. Yes, literally with the KGB, Yevgeny Primakov at the time. And looking to establish, an identity for these people who have now emigrated over all these years, settlers that is, emigrated, Arabs and Muslims from all over the Middle East, after the Israelis have built the land up into a prosperous, modern, technologically advanced military powerhouse. They have emigrated. These are immigrants. They are settlers that came from Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Iraq and other places around the Middle East. And they settled in these areas. But to give them an identity that's somehow distinct from calling them Egyptians, Syrians, Jordanians, and so forth, the KGB and Yasser Arafat also go back to the Tanakh. And they dredge up the name of the Israelites' enemies. Once again, the Philistines, and apply that name to these immigrant settlers from all over the Arab-speaking world. And they call it the Palestine Liberation Organization. And eventually try to apply that name. By the way, the PLO is the Palestinian Authority today. That's what the Palestinian Authority is comprised of, the PLO, Fatah, Islamic Jihadi terror groups. But they applied that name to the people of this area who were no more a single united recognizable people than than if we here in the United States were to, I don't know, take the Great Lakes and region of upper Midwest United States, and we'll say, oh, anybody living around there, they're Great Lakers, and we'll give them nationhood. They're Great Lakers. It's absurd, right? Well, the same thing with these people, now called Palestinians by the KGB and Yasser Arafat and the PLO. And by the way, the flag that you see flown all over the place now, red, green, black, and white flag, is actually the flag of the PLO. That's originally the flag of the PLO, a terrorist organization.
So,
So what I'm
Claire.
saying is that there's no such thing as Palestine. There's no such thing as the Palestinian people. There are Arabs and Muslims that live in these areas. There are Gazans who live in Gaza, Arabs, Muslims who live in Judea and Samaria. There's no such thing as Palestinians. They don't exist.
So, Claire, today we're starting to see some Western states recognize that a two-state solution is what might be best, according to them. Do you think that we are going to see more and more countries calling for a two-state solution? And what do you think the implications will be if that does happen?
Well, it's not going to happen, so we can just be sure of that. But there have been quite a few, many dozens of countries, including European countries, that have declared support for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Now, if we were to ask any of them, well, what are the boundaries of this place? What's its government? Is it parliamentary? Is it monarchy? Is it what is it? Where's the capital? When was that established? Who is the leadership? Do you have a parliament? Do you have a governing body? None of that exists and never will. None of that exists. There cannot. I mean, there's no such thing. So
So,
no, of course, it's not going to happen. It's virtue signaling by many of these who have declared support for such an imaginary state. They know it's imaginary. They know it's never going to happen. But they're virtue signaling. And I think, unfortunately, a good part of that may have to do with the change in the makeup of their own population, which has seen massive immigration, settlement, hijra by populations coming from the Middle East and being allowed by the millions, literally, into these countries, Britain, France, Germany, and so forth.
You brought up, I think, and very well you did it, about the KGB and the Russian role in Palestine and the area that declares itself Palestine. I want to push that slightly into domestic politics a bit. As the Democratic Party has become more socialist and more radical, we're seeing at the same time it's becoming more in favor of, or more anti-Israel, perhaps is the best, more succinct way of stating it. Why this romance between Russia and the more radical elements in the Middle East?
Well, the Russians, as I said, going back at least to the late 50s, early 1960s with Yasser Arafat, as well as a presence or seeking a foothold, a presence, for example, in warm water ports. We've seen along the Mediterranean when the Hafez al-Assad and then Bashar al-Assad, dynasty, I guess you'd call it, allowed Russian establishment of Russian military facilities, Tartus, Latakia, for example. And so they've always sought, the Russians have always sought a presence for a number of reasons. Certainly those ports, key strategically located ports along the Mediterranean, one. Again, I'll go back to Syria, Tartus and Latakia, being naval and air bases, respectively. They're not there anymore now, but they have always sought that. But also, by means of that, And the influence, for example, again, with the Assad regime in Damascus, to extend influence and power, project influence and power into the Middle East region, backing for some of the other terrorist organizations, PFLP, Palestinian Liberation, the People's Liberation, People's Liberation Palestinian, whatever that is. And the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, to project influence and gain a foothold from which to project influence and power in the Middle East, critical region, geographically, strategically speaking, that would counter a US presence, a US projection of power and influence in the region, and by means of countering, therefore, Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, our United States American number one top ally and partner in the region.
Claire, I'd like to bring in a country that we haven't talked about yet that's operating in the Middle East, even if it's behind the scenes, and that's China. We see the Iranians and the Chinese having meetings, having influence in there. What is China's role in the sense of what China wants to do in the Middle East? What kind of policies do you see them supporting? Are they supporting Hamas? Are they supporting a breakup of a destruction of Israel, Russians in Syria? What do you see as Russia's game plan there?
You
I mean,
mean
excuse
China's?
me, I'm
China's?
sorry, China's game
Right,
plan there.
China's. Exactly. So, China's strategy and objectives are a little bit different than Russia's. China's regime, the CCP, Chinese Communist Party's regime, is more focused on commercial commerce, connections, economic presence and expansion. And even though, yes, there were very, I don't know if people know this, very close ties between some of the Hamas senior leadership. I'll name, for example, Mohammed
Yep.
Deif, now not very dearly departed, off to meet his virgins last year. He, earlier on in his career, if you want to call it that, had was granted a study position with the People's Liberation of Army in China to study artillery. He spent some time in China. I guess they even gave him a Chinese wife or something. And he was there for a number of years. So that connection absolutely did extend to Hamas leadership. But more broadly, the Chinese Communist Party interest in the region is strategic, but based more on economics, than perhaps anything else. And so we see China looking to extend, its Belt and Road Initiative, the Chinese economic corridor through Pakistan that they want to extend all the way westward, through Iran even and to the Persian Gulf. Not happening yet, but that's the idea. The interest of China in a position, let's say, with the port of Haifa on the Mediterranean in Israel, that sort of thing. But it is slow going, and of course, with the Chinese economy basically imploding at the moment, that's not going so well.
You mentioned the end of the Russian port facilities in Tartus. We've seen reports that the Russian fleet in the Mediterranean has been facing some real problems. Their ships are rusting out. There's some significant supply problems. They're not doing well at all. Is that part of the challenge that the Russians are facing since the basically loss of a lot of more influence in Syria?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they lost their naval base there in what at least used to be called Syria. I'm not sure there is a Syria anymore. There's a Damascus regime, but Syria, not so sure. But at that point, when Bashar al-Assad, was being overthrown, that being last December 2024, with the lightning fast advance of the Turkish backed Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and al-Shara, Ahmed al-Shara, at that point, the Russian ships lost that port at Tartus, pulled out to sea. And there, as you say, Frank, kind of have been wasting away, rusting away, without that facility anymore to be able to use for a port refurbishing and whatever. So they are, facing quite a bit of challenges there. And of course, if you go, then from the Mediterranean through the Bosporus. Into the Black Sea. Well, that channel too has not been quite as welcoming, let's say, to the Russian Navy as it had been before. And again, remember, it was the Turkish-backed Hayat Tahrir al-Sham that took over Damascus, right? So, and then in the Black Sea, you've got the Ukrainians that have really mastered shore-to-ship offensive drone strikes that really have denied freedom of movement for any Russian naval ships in the Black Sea, and they've retreated yet further through one more strait, the Kerch Strait between the Black Sea leading into the Sea of Azov, and that's where their ships have had to take I don't know what, refuge. So it's not a good scene for the Russians, no.
Claire, you mentioned drones, and I do want to ask you this. We see that Iran has put up money and factories building drones, which are later sold or given to the Russians, which are then using them in Ukraine. We see that we've got both things happening in Tajikistan that way, as well as in Kazakhstan. Central Asia is another flashpoint for us. We see ch both China and Russia to some degree competing in that region. Can the US do anything to attract, say, Kazakhstan with its uranium and different issues that are going on? Can we pull Central Asia away from China and Russia, do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously, as we know, the geography, the Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, lie right between China and Russia. And obviously, those five formerly were republics within the Soviet Union, but broke away, of course, in 1991 when the Soviet Union broke up. They do have quite a few. Natural resources. They're rich in many minerals, as you mentioned. And it's it's a natural point of contest between China and Russia. I don't know how extensively the United States has sought to bolster bilateral ties to each of those five. But yes, we certainly ought to be.
It's interesting. You mentioned going back to the Roman Empire days in the Middle East. Well, if you go back to Peter the Great, we have seen that Russia's international path, goals really haven't changed very much since Peter the Great, have they?
No, Russia, like China, honestly, the both of them are not really countries in the sense of the term a nation state. Rather, each of those, Russia and China, each is an empire, and each has reached its current geographical boundaries by means of conquest. Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, Vladimir Putin. And in China, the same thing. I mean, all of the peoples, plural, that make up China today, talk about the Mongolians, the Manchurians, the Cantonese, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs. These were basically independent people. These are not Mandarin, originally Mandarin speaking peoples. They were conquered and forcibly incorporated into the modern day Empire of China. Well, It's the same thing in Russia. And the nature of empires is what? It's expansion. And especially once, as in 1991, what Vladimir Putin calls the worst catastrophe of his life, an empire loses parts of the empire that it had held previously. And in the Soviet Union's case, 14 of the 15 socialist republics broke away, as we said, the five from Central Asia, but others as well. And of course, the Warsaw Pact, countries of Eastern Europe broke away to freedom, and many are now members of NATO. Horrors. So, Vladimir Putin, as a modern day would-be warlord, emperor, is bent upon recapturing, some of these breakaway regions, not just for themselves, their geographical significance, the natural resources for which, by the way, Ukraine is full, but also ideologically. And the reason that Putin and Russia invaded Ukraine back in February of 2022 is not anything to do really with NATO. Ukraine was not then a member of NATO, was not going to be eligible to be a member of NATO for years of foreseeing in the future, is not now eligible to be a member of NATO. That's off the table. NATO's got nothing to do with why Putin and Russia invaded Ukraine. Rather, what I would say is that invasion took place because the Russians and Putin, what they really fear, they fear the contagion of freedom, the contagion of Western liberal democratic style governance based on individual liberty, the sovereign independent nation state. They feared that contagion blowing eastward across Russian borders. And good grief, what if the Russian people caught that virus?
Claire, oh, go ahead,
Go ahead,
Frank.
Daria.
I was just going to say that Russia has always feared a two-front war from both the East and the West, and we've seen them attacked from over their borders many times. After World War II, China lost a lot of land in Eastern Russia to the Russians. There was an agreement in recent years, between China and Russia to say the borders basically are going to stay the way they are. However, I've seen documents from meetings with Chinese leaders that have indicated that China is willing to reconsider taking back some of that territory, whether it is in a kinetic conflict or an economic one. But do you see any of that conflict happening? That land would literally include Vladivostok, an all-weather port for the Russians. It would include, I believe, pipeline areas that are the gas and oil pipelines that are between China and Russia. It would include areas where ethnically and language-wise, the people inside Russia still speak Mandarin and their schools are taught in Mandarin today. Do you see this as a potential flashpoint between these two communist states?
Well, not so much a flashpoint, but a fun fact first. I wrote my master's thesis about the economic and natural resources of Siberia. Yes, long time ago.
Frank, she's too bright, Frank.
Unfortunately, this is before the internet, so you know how long ago that was, and it had to be typed out on paper, which is how it exists to this day. But yes, the Russian and the Chinese populations are in a demographic death spiral. China, of course, murdered its girl babies for 36 years. What did they think was going to happen? The population of China, by the end of the 21st century, current trends continuing, is projected to perhaps be even fewer people than the United States population at the end of this century, if we can imagine that. Russia as well is losing population. through early life expectancy, death, early deaths, low life expectancy for men in particular, but also more abortions taking place than live births. In Russia, the birth rate is something like the 1 point, I don't know, two, three, way below replacement rate of 2.1. Same thing for China. So in a way, as I earlier thought, like you were projecting kind of there, Daria, that that China might make a move, whether economically, just population kind of surge at the border, or military, would make some kind of a move to regain those territories in the Far East that once were under the Chinese emperors, or not. I think that the Russian population crash means that they won't be able to hold on to Siberia, whether they wanted to or not, just because they won't have the people. I mean, first of all, who want to live out there, move out there. But just the population and the administrative ability to hang on to those vast spaces, what is it, 10, 12 time zones. So I can see that happening. Yeah.
Particularly in the case of China, we've spoken about this on this program on a number of occasions. When you have reduced job opportunities for young Chinese men and women, when you have Chinese young men not able to find wives, girlfriends, that leaves you with a dangerous population of bored, frustrated young men. And there's nothing more dangerous to a nation's stability than having a large population of bored, frustrated young men.
Yes.
How much of a danger does that present? I mean, many dictatorships will look to that situation and say, well, if we can't employ them in factories and in jobs, well, let's put them in the army and let's use that army for something. How much of a
Yeah.
danger is that?
Well, I think it's a very serious danger, and you're right to point it out. Absolutely, Frank. There are something like 30 to 40 million young Chinese men, as you say. They call them bare branches, because they will not ever have a family or children. There's huge, number one, there's huge human trafficking of women from throughout East Asia, Thailand, Burma, Vietnam, so forth. But that's not the answer. But 30 to 40 million young men, as you say, bored, frustrated, and without wives or even girlfriends, what are you gonna do with them? Certainly, we know that China, Xi Jinping, have designs on conquering Taiwan. But I'll mention one other, I don't know, channel through which maybe they're sending some of, at least some of these young men, and that is across our own United States southern border. Where reporters like Todd Bensman, formerly at the Center for Immigration Studies, but now having joined the Department of Homeland Security, working with Tom Homan there and Secretary Kristi Noem, other journalist Michael Yan, who spent a lot of time down south of Mexico, even down to the Darien Gap. The passageway, really, that jungle, wild, rugged jungle area that lies between northern South America, Colombia, and the southernmost state of Central America, which is Panama, and that rugged area there, it's not developed, very, very difficult terrain and raging rivers and so forth. But these reporters, in particular Michael Yan, but Todd Bensman to some extent too, reporting over the last several years of the Biden administration, when our southern border was wide open, but that they saw personally, were there, especially on the Panamanian side, in a village, let's say, on the Panamanian side of the Darien Gap, watching thousands and thousands and thousands of young, fit, military age, military bearing looking young Chinese men stumbling out of the Darien Gap, arriving in Panama, where white buses awaited them to carry them further north, al norte, all the way to our border and across. I will give you one story that Michael Yan told about a time when he was in a Panamanian village, just the Panamanian side of the Darien Gap. And he talked, of course, to the villagers there. And they told him, they said, they also had seen, all these young Chinese men coming through. But the Panamanians also said they saw them doing something which was really kind of gross and bizarre. And that was that they were buying chickens and killing them and then drinking shots of the blood of the chickens. And the Panamanians had no idea what this was. Michael Yan didn't know what that was. He contacted a mutual friend of ours, Li Mengyan, Dr. Li Mengyan, a virologist, epidemiologist who escaped out of Hong Kong, a UN laboratory in Hong Kong in 2020, and made her way to the United States. Anyway, contacted her and said, What is this? What's going on? What are these guys doing? And she said, oh, that drinking of chicken's blood is the signature training ritual of a People's Liberation Army of China Special Operations Battalion. And they have now moved on
Wow.
up, as we said, to our border, across our border. We don't know how many, 10, 15,000 of them. They're called Jungle Tigers. Their nickname, Jungle Tigers. They're here. They're in the United States. Maybe that's one of the escape valves, but it's also a very serious national security threat here in the United States.
Claire, I could talk to you all day long. These are such interesting topics and things. And I've studied China and you for me every time that you bring new information in. I want to throw something out with you in the energy area, if I could, real quick. China recently has announced the finding of large reserves of thorium, which is used in molten reactors, molten salt reactors. They have, it's going to depend on how easy to process, et cetera, obviously, but they will have approximately twice the amount that the United States has, although a similar amount if we include Australia and some other of our allies in the amount available to us. What could the Chinese do militarily with having really a lot of energy available in sparsely populated areas, because we're seeing developments in Inner Mongolia. We're seeing missile silos out in northwestern China and different places. What would these thorium reactors be for, be used for when the areas are so sparsely populated? It seems the plans must be in place for building them for some reason. The Chinese just don't do things out of the goodness of their heart for villagers.
Well, we'll have to watch those developments to be sure. And, the Chinese have built all kinds of cities full of apartment buildings that are completely empty. So, yeah, they do build without actually any plans for utilization. But China does control a lot of the rare earth elements that are critically important for not just a technology industry, but also our military. The thing is that they could in the case, I mean, and our leadership recognizes this, certainly the new leadership, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and his team, they recognize that would be a serious threat to American national security were the Chinese to decide to cut off exports supply of some of these rare, or just not even rare earth elements, but certainly critical minerals, cobalt, lithium, others. Now, here's the thing. The United States is rich in many of these elements, many of these minerals. But under prior administrations, these deposits were not allowed to be mined for and in addition, the refining facilities were not allowed to be built. You know, greeny energy and all that nonsense, right? But I think the current administration of President Trump, and certainly the leadership at the Pentagon, again, Pete Hegseth and all of his team, they recognize this. You know, certainly as a serious element of our own national security, and they're taking steps to open up some of those lands, those places where mining these elements, these minerals, you know, has long been stymied. That's now being opened up. Plus, there are other places around the world, among countries who are our partners and allies, with whom we probably need to expand partnership on development of some of these minerals as well. So that's what I think we need to be doing.
Well, thanks to Claire Lopez, our special guest today. Anyone listening to the show has received a master class version of world affairs. You should go tell your local college just to give you the degree because of what you've just heard. Claire, thank you so much. We have to have you on again as soon as possible.
Okay, thanks so much, Frank and Daria both, and I will be happy to come back on with you whenever you'd like. Let me know.
Thank you so much. And to our audience, thanks for tuning in today.
We welcome our newest radio affiliate in Tucson, Arizona at 95.5 FM. Welcome, Tucson. It joins Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM, Las Vegas, Nevada, 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida, 92.1 FM, Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM, Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM, Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM, Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM, and in Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM. We're also available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, and the Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune into our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and public broadcast TV. You can also access our program anytime on our website at usagovpolicy.com. Thanks for listening and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc., at usagovpolicy.com and the Institute for American Politics. Email us at truthinradio@gmail.com. And tune into the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network.
Our producer and director is the brilliant Jeff Hansen.